court, the class program is run by the Supreme Court and the State Bar in a two-time national winner of outreach programs. And the students here have received material about this case. They may have invited counsel in to discuss the case with them. And these students will meet with me at noon, and they will be joined perhaps by students from Altoona High School and New Holstein High School. So they return. Now that we have met you, I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right is Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case for this morning, which is 98-3033, Waukesha County versus Stephen H. Representing Waukesha County is Anton Jamison. You may proceed. Mr. Jamison, you're going to be talking 15 minutes. Mr. Grau, the guardian ad litem, will have 10 minutes. And then Mr. Voss will have 30 minutes. Is that agreeable? And you have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
That's correct, Chief Justice. Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. It's an honor and a privilege to appear before you today in the case involving Brittany H. I guess at the outset, I'd like to let the court know that what this case is about and what it's not about. This case is not about whether parents should receive written TPR warnings. I think we all agree that parents should receive written TPR warnings. The issue in this case is whether the provision of written TPR warnings 4 months after an initial out-of-home placement, with a termination petition being filed a year after that, is sufficient to meet the provisions of 48.415 sub 2 of the Wisconsin statutes. What we're seeking is for this court to either overrule in the interest of DF or at the very least limit DF to the facts of its case. The facts in this case, Your Honors, a petition to determine whether Brittany H. was a child in need of protection services was filed in February of 1995. The original petition dealt with allegations of neglect under 48.13 sub 10 and sub 10M. The facts of that concerned allegations regarding the mother's alleged cocaine abuse. Conditions of supervision were entered in this case in April of 1995. Now, subsequent to April of 1995, I believe it was November 17th, 1995, Brittany was removed from the care of her mother and placed in the home of her paternal grandparents. That change was done pursuant to 48.357 sub 2, the emergency change of placement statute. Approximately 4 days later, based on information from the paternal grandparents, they could not care for Brittany any longer. Brittany's placement was again changed under 48.357 sub 2 to a foster home, where she has remained ever since. In January of 1996, a petition for extension and revision was filed, and in March of 1996, conditions of return were established, oral termination of parental rights were given to both parents, and written termination of parental rights were given in that case. Approximately 1 year after that, a termination of parental rights petition was filed, and then we have all the procedural things that bring us up to court today. Initially, the mother voluntarily terminated parental rights. The father contested the termination of parental rights, eventually getting to the point where I believe in December of 1997, he purportedly voluntarily terminated his parental rights. Contested disposition was set for the case in April of 1998. Following that, there was a motion for post-judgment relief. Mockner hearing was eventually scheduled in December of 1998. Then briefs were filed to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals ruled that DF was controlling the guardian litem and the county. Petitioned this court for review, and that kind of brings us up to date today.
Mr. Jamieson, let me ask you about the initial emergency placement and then the transfer. My recollection of some of the arguments presented by petitioners are to the effect that these really are not orders, that the order was supervision in the county department, and that where you had an emergency placement and then a transfer, that those are really not orders that require the warning. So I think that's the guardian ad litem's brief, if I remember correctly. Do you agree with that argument, or do you think these are indeed orders?
I believe that the issue between orders and authorization, I think it's a little outside the scope of the statutes. I mean, I agree that there is an issue there. Perhaps it was an order, perhaps it wasn't an order, but 48.356 and 48.415 state change of placements accomplished pursuant to 48.357. There's no exception given, I think, for order or authorization or anything like that. So, and there's no exception for, you know, out-of-home placements pursuant to 48.357 except 48.357 sub 2. So I think that, while I think there is a question regarding order and authorization, I believe that written termination warnings were probably required, even if it was just an authorization.
You started out indicating that you wanted us to overrule DF or to limit that case to its facts. If we were to overrule DF, are you urging us to indicate that the rule is substantial compliance?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking that the court overrule DF and recognize that the language in 48.415 sub 2 requires one or more orders. I don't believe we need to get to the issue of substantial compliance. I was able to attend an oral argument back in, I think it was October 12th. It was a criminal case, and I believe the Chief Justice and Justice Bradley in that case were concerned about the bar being set at a minimum, and then people coming in and saying, well, that's not the minimum anymore, that's the midpoint, and now we have a new minimum. I think one of the problems with substantial compliance is that you could start a race to the bottom. What is substantial compliance? Substantial compliance to me is different than what Attorney Boss would think, what Attorney Grau would think, what any judge would think.
So you really would urge us to take the position that as long as it's in one order or accompanies one order, that is sufficient?
Yes.
No, I understand, counsel, right now that if there is a misnotice, and I used to sit on the trial bench, and I remember DF coming out, basically you always go back to goal or to start. I mean, there's no way if you miss the notice or for whatever reason, so you could have a lengthy process, and these are always rather lengthy, and I noticed there were at least a dozen hearings in this case. You have to go back to the beginning. Is that correct? Is there any midpoint that this case could have returned to, or did it have to start off because of the ineffective notices at the beginning?
Based on DF, once, I don't recall the date that the court sent out the notices of change in placement, but I'll assume it was, let's say it was November 30th. If on December 1st, someone noticed that a termination of parental rights warnings was not concluded, that's defective under DF. DF is more than actual compliance, it's strict compliance. So at that point, it would be defective. In the past, one option to get around the defect is to file a new petition. You would need to have grounds for a new petition, and as you're all aware, it's not just, I think the child's in need of protection services, that it has to meet certain burdens, clear and convincing evidence. Then there would have to be a dispositional hearing. There are time limits for that. That would continue to extend the hearing.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if I understand your pages 14 and 15, Justice Wilcox says you start at ground zero. But you put the child back into the house, don't you have to find new grounds? You can't go under the old grounds, or have I just read your brief?
What I believe we would need to do is we would need to have new grounds.
So it's not even ground. Depends on what you mean by ground zero. It's not back to the very beginning of this case. You'd have to start a new proceeding on new grounds, so the parent would have to do something else to the child that would justify beginning the proceedings.
That's correct. In essence, we would have to return the child and hope for the worst.
Counsel, you correctly, I guess, anticipate some concerns that I have with substantial compliance, because it's such an amorphous concept and subjective. Would you articulate this one or more statutory construction argument that you made?
Your Honor, I believe that there's nothing inherent in the phrase one or more. And part of my reasoning is from In the Interest of KK, which came out right after DF, which is the Court of Appeals decision. And KK is background, I'm sure all of you know it already. That was an abandonment case. And in there, the court interpreted basically the letter A to mean you just need one. I don't think there's anything inherent in the phrase one or more that requires this court to import the procedural requirements of 48356 into 48415 sub 2. I believe that there have been, I believe that the vitality of DF has been limited by this court's opinion in Anthony C., by the change in the juvenile code in 1995, where prior to 1995, the best interests of the child were paramount, but it was kind of further down the statute and there were other considerations. In 1995, the legislature moved it up and said said the best interests of the child are paramount. I think that all of those in consideration warrant following the strict language of one or more versus interpreting another statutory provision into that.
Well, one of the problems that I have with your just plain overruling DF is that it seems to me that in this long process, and this takes a while, that it would make a difference as to when these warnings, I'm talking about the one warning, you're saying just one, would be given. In other words, this is not it's not a smooth track. You're dealing with a lot of dysfunctional situations. I could envision that if you gave the warning, and in this case it was given toward the end rather than in the beginning, do you see any problem with at what stage this one warning would be given?
I think that, and I don't know how the court would craft an opinion stating that one or more means one later versus one earlier, and I recognize the concerns that the court has mentioned. What happens if 5 years pass after the written warnings are given? Sometimes the parents are not exactly sophisticated. They might not recall, though I would submit to the court that once a parent is told that their parental rights are terminated, that even the least sophisticated parent, I think, has cause for concern and is concerned at that point.
The situation I'm thinking, you have an early warning and then the things, then the departments are working with these people, working and working, and they come back in, you have an extension, they're working, and then finally, all of a sudden, there's a termination, but there's no notice. And that's exactly what I was thinking about because of the length of time.
And I think that that's, and I guess maybe that's one of the concerns with Anthony C. that this court decided last term. The court decided, I think the essence of that decision is when a child is originally placed out of home, sort of that's the clarion call to the parent, and the warning provides that wake up for the parent that they've got to work on the conditions. But under Anthony C., if there's no subsequent return home or another out of home placement, that you could have 2, 3, 4, 5 years where the warnings aren't there. I guess as far as notice goes, perhaps parents could raise an argument in court that too much time has passed and that they didn't, that they're no longer on notice that it happened. But as far as I can't really give the court some direction on how to interpret one or more to mean at least 1 year before the.
Well, maybe you can interpret it that the warning is given in adequate time so that the conditions necessary for replacing the child in the home could be complied with. I mean, if you're going to give this warning immediately before you terminate parental, before you terminate parental rights, the parent doesn't have an opportunity to do this. Do whatever is required. Now, as Justice Wilcox said, maybe having worked with social services, they've been told and told and told. But that isn't what the statute says. The statute says the judge is supposed to tell them. Maybe we have to post notices in every courtroom, in children's court, that says this. Or maybe there has to be a handout. And that, of course, only deals with the people that show up. Maybe there's got to be a form that with every form that's given to a parent, that there's this notice as to that case. I mean, what about any of those?
Well, I guess those are all feasible options. However, once, for example, just Wilcox had stated that several cases occur or several hearings occur in a case, and I don't want to really argue contrary to my position, but if notices are posted in the court and the parent comes in 12, 15, 18, 20 times, that it no longer is meaningful notice because it just becomes part of the background. You know, it's, and I'm sure all of you have experience with this from your experiences as attorneys and as judges, that parents get a stack of papers and, regardless of if it's a criminal case or a civil case, sometimes you can't count on them to read through everything and understand everything that's in those materials. I guess the best case scenario, if you have one or more cases, is that the termination occurs right after the warning, or not right after, but 6 months, 12 months after it. But I suspect that one potential drawback is, as you had stated, Chief Justice, what happens if the parent can't be located? Then does the child continue in impermanence until you can actually locate that parent and then administer the warnings, then wait the statutorily required period of time?
The statutory required period of time for CHIPS is 6 months. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. In Brittany's case, it used to be the statute split out children who were 3 or younger. In Brittany's case, it was 6 months for children 3 or younger, 12 months if the child is older than that. But I don't know if it was the recent revision of the legislature, but now it's 6 months regardless of the age of the child.
6 months of continuing CHIPS before a TPR can be filed.
Yes, a lot of the other provisions don't have time periods.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jamieson, Mr. Grau. You are the guardian ad litem.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Chief Justice Abrahamson, Associate Justices, my name is John Grau, and I am the guardian ad litem for Brittany. I was first appointed guardian ad litem for Brittany shortly after her birth. She was born in February of 1995. At that time, her mother was incarcerated, and it resulted in the filing of a CHIPS petition. I've been reappointed on and off since that time. And obviously, we all know the role of the guardian ad litem is to advocate for what the guardian ad litem believes is in the best interest of his ward. And in this case, at this stage of the game, it's my understanding, my duty here would be to try to argue regarding the statutory interpretation of these statutes and how we can interpret those things in the best interests of children like Brittany. This is a statutory interpretation case. There's two main statutes involved. The first one is 48.356, and the other one is obviously 48.415 sub 2. Obviously, the first thing you have to try to discern is the legislative intent, and in the Children's Code, we do have at least a guide, a little push to figure out what the legislative intent is governing how we interpret these statutes. And just briefly, I'll comment on a couple of those things. 4801 requires that when construing the chapter, the best interests of the children be paramount. Interestingly enough, some statutes have been repealed, such as 48.01 sub B, that at one point directed that a goal of the chapter was to preserve families whenever possible. That's been repealed with an emphasis on trying to preserve families when appropriate. And there is now in the Children's Code a direct recognition of the authority of a court to terminate a parent's parental rights. With that kind of background on how we try to discern what the Children's Code means, you know, I'd look at what does 48.356 mean. The question here, and I think my argument is that DF should be overruled. I think it's at odds with other case law that's come down following DF. The DF court, if you read that decision, found that 48.356 itself, not compliance with that statute, barred a TPR action. There's nothing in 48.356 that says that. That is a CHIP statute. I understand they're all in the Children's Code. It's not even in the termination of parental rights section of the code. DF did not construe the termination of parental rights statute at issue there at all. That was made plain in subsequent case law, for instance, KK, which came out of, I believe, the same district, which held that in an abandonment case, you don't incorporate 48.356 when determining whether or not a TPR petition is barred. Justice Sunby,
Interrupt you at that point because I want to ask exactly what you're getting into. In our opinion in Anthony C., we distinguished in the interest of KK, and we did it by saying, well, that's abandonment.
Right.
And that's a different situation. How can we now use that case in this situation? This situation is, as I understand it, not an allegation of abandonment.
No. Well, there was, I'm sorry, there was an abandonment
but
allegation.
But that isn't what the court relied on.
Right.
The court relied on the allegations tied to the CHIPS petition.
Right.
And what else?
I'm sorry.
Did the court also rely on the fact there had been no contact between parent and child?
This is a continuing CHIPS case.
Okay.
What happened is Stephen waived the fact-finding hearing on the continuing CHIPS ground in exchange for a dismissal of the abandonment charge. Not a dismissal, but there was no finding on the abandonment.
So
and
the
then
court
contested.
Really did rely strictly on the CHIPS.
Yes, that's right. That's
termination.
Right. That's right.
If that's indeed the case, and I understand it is, and in Anthony C., we indicated that the interest of KK was distinguished because it was an abandonment case, how can we now use that case in regard to the CHIPS grounds?
Well, I think what Anthony C. does in that case is tell us that DF is wrong. You do look at the termination of parental rights statute. I'm not asking that we look at the abandonment statute, but we look at the continuing CHIPS statute to decide what warnings have to be given. I think Anthony C. is contrary to DF, because DF doesn't look at... If DF's logic was applied to the KK case, there would have been no discussion of what 48.415 sub 1, the abandonment statute, required. It just would have said, you didn't comply with 48.356. Therefore, you missed a warning, you lose. But the court went beyond that, and the court, I think, in Anthony C. recognized that the court did that in KK and did not indicate, to my mind anyways, reading it, that that was incorrect. So what I'm saying is, when you look at the the DF case, that has been limited, I think, by decisions since then, and basically said that that's wrong. We did it wrong there. We said 48356, a violation of that is a bar. Basically, what they're saying in DF is that means that a TPR court loses competency to have a TPR hearing if you haven't complied with this CHIP statute. I think that's incorrect. And I think that's incorrect because of some case law also. I think in the briefs we cited Kiwanda F, where there was a claim in a delinquency case that a court made a mistake by not advising, I think, a parent or a juvenile of a right to substitution. It was held that did not affect the court's competency to have a delinquency hearing. What it did is give the complainant something to complain about if they could raise a motion and show prejudice. That case, Kiwanda F., also cited Robert D., which was a TPR case. Same kind of thing.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose we do accept this. Then is your argument that since 356 is not in termination of parental rights, there's no duty to warn?
No, no.
And what are you going to do? What do you want the court to read in, and how do you want them to change the words of 48356?
I don't want them to change the words of 48356. I think 48356 is what it is. It says you have to warn. A court should warn. The question is, what do you do? What's the remedy if the court doesn't warn?
Okay, so the court has a duty, as I understand your argument, to comply with 48.356 to warn.
Definitely.
In a termination of parental rights situation.
Well, in a CHIPS. It's a CHIPS case when there's a possibility of a TPR.
So now we're into termination of parental rights, and the court hasn't given warning.
You can't proceed with a continuing CHIPS because the statutes require a warning. The termination of parental rights statute requires a warning. So you can't file a TPR action unless you give that warning.
And what's the remedy when you don't have a warning?
Well, you don't need a remedy because you can't file. There's no jurisdictional basis to file a TPR.
What do you
petition.
Want to do in this case?
Well, I think you can interpret 48.415(2) to require one warning must be given. And it must be given at least 6 months prior to the TPR petition being filed.
Where do you get that?
From the wording of the statute. 48.415(2). If you take the language of the statute, continuing need of protection or services, that the child has been adjudged to be in need of protection or services and placed or continued in a placement outside his or her home pursuant to one or more court orders, etc. That's sub A. Sub C, that the child has been outside the home for a cumulative total period of 6 months or longer pursuant to such orders. So you need the orders, but there's also a jurisdictional requirement in the statute that the order must be at least 6 months preceding the filing of a termination petition.
One or more orders. The way that you can read that is one or more orders containing, so at least one order containing. That's the way you read
it. Yes.
It's your position that if others may read it, one or more order, and if it were necessary that all of the orders had it, it would be each containing, or you can put that in brackets.
Obviously.
It's your position, one or more order containing, one suffices. That's your argument.
Yes.
I have some concern. It seems to me in some other cases that I'm referring to Jamie L. Let me read you some language construing 356(2).
Okay.
And I want you to respond. In Jamie L., we said, regarding 356(2), well-informed people could not reasonably differ about what these words mean. Section 48, 356(2) unambiguously requires that any written order which places a child outside the home has to have the notification.
Right.
How do you respond to that language as a counter to your argument?
I think it's true. I mean, in the CHIPS case, a court must give the warning. It's directed that the court give the warning. As I said, the question is, what do we do if the court doesn't? I mean, does that mean we are barred from filing a termination of parental rights petition? I don't think it is. I think.
So your answer then is, what do we do? Is what?
Well, maybe if we look at that, the warnings 356 applies to more than just, in my opinion, this continuing CHIPS type of case. there's perhaps a case that would come down, failure to assume parental responsibility. That statute doesn't incorporate the warnings at all. So if someone filed a petition under that statute, we're not going to have this question about meeting the elements. If a parent in that case was not given the warnings under 48356, what I think they should do is what was done in Kiwanda F and the other cases like that. They would have the right to file a motion saying they were prejudiced by not receiving this warning. And if they could prove prejudice, they could prevail on having the termination petition dismissed. So I think there would be a remedy for that. But if you have a statute in the TPR section of the statutes that references just what we need on the warnings, I think we follow that. And the purpose of the warnings is to give, obviously, notice to the parents that they can do something. A parent isn't entitled to extensions. A parent isn't entitled to a certain period of time, in my belief, under the statute, more than 6 months to meet the conditions of return. And if you've given the warnings and you've given 6 months and the parent has not been able to comply, you've met the jurisdictional requirements. There is nothing gained by saying if you miss a warning early on, you're forever barred. The parent doesn't gain anything as far as notice goes by requiring that we dismiss the petition and refile a CHIPS or something like that. The purpose of the statute will be met by giving one warning at least 6 months prior to filing a termination petition. I see the lights on. So.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Brown.
You.
Mr. Boss, representing Stephen H.
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Thomas Boss. My client, Stephen H., is present in the courtroom today as well. It is our position that the statutes that are being presented for construction to the court today are imposed requirements upon the county in proceeding CHIPS termination case and continuing need of protection and services case, that there is a requirement that all orders which have the effect of either removing or continuing a child outside the parent's home need to advise the parent that his or her parental rights could be terminated in the event that the parent is unable to meet conditions set by the court for return of the child. I think the construction the court has previously put on section 48.356 is the appropriate construction. Clearly, that section of the statutes requires that any such out-of-home placement order warn the parent that the parental rights could be terminated. It also requires that the court adopt conditions the parent must meet for the return of that child to their home. I think the Waukesha County in this case and the guardian ad litem are asking the court to look at that particular section of the statutes as a section that only has application in CHIPS proceedings, but the clear purpose of the warnings and the conditions for return notices, and there's no purpose to have those notices in a CHIPS proceeding. The purpose of those notices is to give the parent the warning that parental rights could be terminated and has been made by the statute an element of proof in termination of parental rights cases.
Mr. Boss, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're not being picked up on the tape recording, the marshal says. So if you would raise the podium at your left hand, at the top there's a button right. Thank you. This is a high-tech court.
This is kind of scary.
Okay.
The purpose of the warnings is a procedural protection for a parent in termination of parental rights proceedings. It may be given in a CHIPS proceeding, but its purpose is to get the parent motivated to get his child back. The purpose leads, I think, to the conclusion that reference to the notices in the termination of parental rights grounds establish that the notices should be an element of proof. In an abandonment case, by virtue of the language of that statute, as the court has interpreted, one notice needs to be given.
Mr. Boss, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
Ask you what you think about this argument. DF is a case that was decided by the Court of Appeals in 1988. In 1992, we decided the Janie L. case. In 1995-96, the legislature amended Chapter 48. And the legislature, among other things, indicated that one of the purposes of Chapter 48 was to promote adoption into stable homes and also to allow termination of parental rights at the earliest possible time. Now, do you think that given those changes in Chapter 48, given that directive by the legislature in Chapter 48 in terms of interpretation, that that overrides those earlier decisions?
I don't believe so, because the particular statute in question hasn't changed. The legislative policy established under Section 4801 continues to recognize the parents' rights as well as those of the child. The changes, I think, are an indication that the legislature is looking more to the efficient resolution of these cases, and I think has adopted a policy or published policy that indicates its acceptance of certain areas of sociology that indicate adoption is, in most cases, an appropriate means for the state to ensure the best interest of the child in many cases. I think it's just a recognition of social policies that would indicate stability in the home is an important thing for a child.
What do you think then the legislature meant by paramount, that paramount consideration in phrase that Justice Crooks just discussed with you?
I think they have attempted to raise the priority of the best interest of the child. There's no question in my mind that that's what that means. However, they didn't do away with the other recognition of the other interests at stake in juvenile court proceedings. Those of the parent, those of the county, and those of the family.
But what you're saying, what I think you're saying, is that it would be unfair to read the notice statute in any other way except that it has to be given each time. It's a question of balancing here, and you don't believe that the best interest of the child being always shall be of paramount consideration would in any way allow it to be read any different than DF indicated.
Well, I don't think the best interest of the child is appropriately dealt with at the trial court level in any case until after you have a determination of facts. In this particular case, we didn't really have a determination of facts, and that's another issue. Prior to the determination of facts, you don't get to a recommendation as to what would be the best disposition in a particular case. The court's decision on the issue of whether the elements of a particular ground for termination have been established deals with just a question of fact. You really don't get into what's in the child's best interest until you get beyond that stage.
Counsel, is it your position that the duty to warn includes any order that changes, for instance, a dispositional order or changes placement, even though initial placement outside the home had already occurred?
I think the statutes are fairly clear. You cannot, either an original dispositional order places a child outside the parent's home. The only other order that can do that is an order under 48.357. The other dispositional orders can continue an out-of-home placement.
So you're saying, initial outside the home, and then there's, as in this case, change of placements. The change of placements order, you believe, under current law, requires the notices to be given. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
Let me give you a hypothetical. I'll tell you why. One of the things that bothers me about this case. Hypothetical. Child is taken outside, placed outside of the home. Notice is given. Change of placement, hypothetically, occurs 30 days later. Notice given. Another change of placement occurs 60 days later. Notice given. Then there's another change of placement. Notice is not given. Couple more changes of placement. Notice given. So we've got one in there where no notice is given. Now, it's your position, then, that there can never be a TPR because of that defect. And what remedy is available to the county is that, let's say, hypothetically, you're dealing with a cocaine mother who is actively involved in cocaine abuse. Your remedy, as you interpret the statutes, is that the child has to go back to the cocaine mother and there has to be a new incidence of a problem that would warrant removal from the home. Is that correct?
Well, I think your hypothetical probably neglects to deal with the prospect that if you do have a cocaine mother situation, you have other possible grounds for termination besides the continuing need of protection and services.
Okay. I can come up with a, you know, it's not a cocaine mother, but a mother that's, or a father that's abusive to the child, that in the past has beaten the child, that has in the past has threatened to rip the heart out of the child, in the past has you know, burned the child all over the body. Let me give that, but doesn't ingest cocaine. And it's your position.
Abuse is another ground, Your Honor.
Child in need of protection and services. A mother that in the past, or father that in the past, has continually left the three-month-old for days on at a period of time. Okay? Now I've got your category, right?
Right.
Okay. Your position is just that, right? You have to give the child back to this situation and wait around until it happens again. And my sense is your answer is going to be yes. My follow-up question is, isn't that immensely inconsistent with the paramount interest of the best child? Could you address that? Because that's a real concern.
It is, Your Honor. It is not consistent with the child's interests under the situation presented to require that type of notice if the child cannot go back to the parent.
Well, but is there any safely. Other remedy? Is there any other remedy?
Well, there should not even be the need to look for a remedy, Your Honor. The county should be putting these notices.
Absolutely, absolutely. Don't disagree with you. My question to you, is there any other remedy?
The other remedy is to maintain the child in care out of home.
But another prime focus of policy in the revision of the code was for permanency and was to promote quick, if you will, not quick, but a timely adoption rather than letting children linger.
That's true.
So your remedy is inconsistent with that policy.
It's inconsistent with that policy, but...
Can you give me a remedy that's not inconsistent with the policy set forth in the revised code?
The remedy is to follow the statute to start with. That's all I can give you.
But once there's been a violation, what is the remedy that you can offer that's not inconsistent with the revised code?
We have an out-of-home placement. Under the initial order in this case, and you have multiple changes subsequent. Change of placement, if there's already an out-of-home placement, change of placement does not place the child outside the parent's home. It's already been done. Change of placement moves the child perhaps from a foster home to another foster home. Under those particular circumstances, it's not an order that really is continuing the placement or changing the placement or making an out-of-home placement. It's already been made. Under circumstances in which out-of-home placement is changed to another out-of-home placement, I'm not certain that the statute would apply in that case.
I thought you said initially that the statute does apply under any change of placement.
Well,
that's why I asked those preparatory questions.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood. I think the change of placement issue is something a little bit different than the original placement versus a change from in-home to out-of-home placement subsequent to an original. The actual placement out or an extension of an out-of-home placement, I think, are required by the statute to give those warnings.
So the yearly extension or whatever?
The yearly extension should give it, or if it's a six-month extension, should also give the warnings. The original out-of-home placement is clearly required by the statute to give the warnings and continuation of out-of-home placement. A change of placement only is required if it's a change from in-home to out-of-home placement, by my reading of the statute.
I have a question. This came up on ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And what the Court of Appeals did is it reversed the order terminating parental rights, right? Is that the effect of the order?
Yes.
All right. Then I looked at your brief to see what relief you want.
Yes.
And you agree with the Court of Appeals that there was ineffective counsel. And you agree that the trial court decision, which is terminating parental rights, should be reversed, right?
That's correct.
And vacate the order terminating, right? And you ask for a new trial, limiting the scope of the trial to the abandonment. Why do you do that?
Well, Your Honor, the part of the claim for ineffective assistance related to a situation in which I felt the Court of Appeals didn't deal with the issue, felt that the trial court didn't meet its obligation in taking the change of plea to a no-contest plea into fact-finding. And the position I have taken on that issue is that if he is allowed to withdraw that plea of no contest, then there would still remain that allegation of abandonment.
You think that under the Court of Appeals decision, that's still a pending matter?
Well, under the Court of Appeals decision did not deal with that issue.
Yeah. And then you also say that you request us to review the issues and argument which the Court of Appeals didn't address, to remand those arguments to the Court of Appeals. What arguments are those?
Those are the arguments, Your Honor, that the trial court failed to adequately take an admission of fact under the provisions of Section 48.422 of the statutes, neither an admission of fact nor testimony relating to the grounds that were found by the trial court. The only thing the trial court addressed at the time the plea was changed to a no-contest plea on the continuing CHIPS grounds were the hearing rights of Stephen.
If this goes back to the Court of Appeals or the trial court and they find abandonment, then where are you?
I don't think they will, Your Honor.
That may be, but what if they do?
If abandonment is found, I would imagine it would be based on not a trial. They actually come out at a trial. I don't. Where would Stephen be? Stephen then would be in a position where his parental rights may well be terminated.
Make sure you speak up, counsel.
His parental rights could be terminated.
Yeah, on abandonment. And that's what you're asking for here, that we send this back on an abandonment issue?
That is the request if the court finds that to be the appropriate remedy under the secondary argument, Your Honor. Otherwise, if the court decides on the, based on the notice issues, I don't believe that it's at that point the remedy should be just a dismissal.
So that's in the alternative.
Yes.
Because you understand the Court of Appeals, that would just end this termination parental rights case.
That was my reading, yes.
Mr. Voss, if this case went back on abandonment, would you concede then that in the interest of KK applies and it's sufficient to have just one order containing the warnings?
I believe the language of that provision, or the statutory provision, was interpreted correctly. Yes, one warning would be.
So you're satisfied that KK would control that?
On the warnings issue, yes.
Could I ask you, sir, if on your position that if the county wanted to terminate parental rights under the present scenario, they might have to start a new petition continuing for CHIPS. Does that start the whole time period over again, too?
Well, Your Honor, once an original CHIPS petition is filed, a new case is opened. What's happened in a prior file doesn't have any direct relevance to the current CHIPS proceeding. There may be some evidential relevance if there's a dispute, but once a new matter, a new petition is filed, you have a new case.
So there would be another, at least a minimum 6-month period?
Well, depends on obviously on the facts of the case, and if a new petition is filed, there may or may not be an out-of-home placement based on the new petition. Uh, there were an out-of-home placement at the time the court enters its order, that would start the waiting period, I guess, before a termination can be filed.
Would that be consistent with the paramount interest of the child?
Procedurally, you need to go through the steps of a fact-finding. Best interests of the child are dealt with in the disposition after the fact-finding. So I think procedurally, you do need to honor the rights of all the parties involved, including the rights of the child. The child will receive a guardian ad litem, depending on age, perhaps even advocate counsel. In this particular case, if a new petition were filed alleging new factors, you need to go through the hearing procedures or waiver of hearing procedures. And the interests of the child are dealt with in the disposition of the case.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Voss? Thank you, Mr. Voss. Mr. Jameson, I have you down for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address some of the issues that Attorney Voss mentioned. He had stated that he had felt that there was no purpose to fail to give notice under 48.356. The statute is mandatory. However, I can inform the court that sometimes, based on the CHIPS petition that's filed, I don't think it's in the best interest of the child for the termination of parental rights to be given, for warnings to be given. And I can provide an example. Under 48.13 sub 4, which is when a parent comes into court and says, I need special assistance in providing for care of my child, frequently the cases that I see with those are the children are suffering from profound developmental or physical disabilities. The parents have gone through a lot of soul searching before they come to the court and ask for the court's jurisdiction. The child is then placed, usually in my experience, in some kind of institutional setting. Frequently it's a group home or something. And then to ask the court to give termination of parental rights warnings to those parents at that time when they've gone through so much to try and help their child, I think just adds insult to injury. If the parents end up not being not compliant or end up abandoning the child, then we can come in, we could bring in a written notice, you know, send written notice to the parents and terminate their parental rights at that time. But I think it's almost heartless to tell these parents, yeah, I know you're having trouble with your children because you don't have the skills to take care of your developmentally disabled child. We are here to help you out, but you know what? Your parental rights are going to be terminated. So thanks for coming to court, but just so you know, your parental rights can be terminated. In regards to the legislative purpose, I think the way to look at the legislative purpose in Chapter 48 is, well, at least for those of us that have glasses, is that the legislative purpose is the way that we view the statute. It's a way to look at the provisions of the statute. Excuse me for a second. Felt like there was a huge tower in front of me. It's a way to view the provisions. Attorney Voss is correct, where there's a separate best interest determination by the court in the dispositional phase. However, the context in which the statutes are looked at is also the best interest of the child as required by 4801. The concerns that have been mentioned in the case about impermanence and the harm to the child aren't imagined, they're real. There have been professionals who've studied it. This court has heard from counsel in the past. This court has stated in other opinions, the harm of impermanence for children. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has mentioned it. The concerns are real. The requirement of having at least one written warning provides that the parents get the warnings so they can comply with the conditions of return. But if they fail to do that, then the best interest of the child will come in, and then they can be placed for adoption if that's what happens. We all want to have children return home to their parents, but there come cases where it's not in the child's best interest to have that happen.
Mr. Jamison, what do you think about the proposal that Mr. Voss seemed to make for his alternative remedy, that one thing this court could do is send this matter back to the trial court and let the trial court proceed on the abandonment allegation? Then, based on KK, there would be no problem with the warning since one warning was given. How do you feel about that approach?
Well, there are a couple of problems, I think, with that. One is in regards to the issue presented by DF and by KK. Those opinions are, the reasoning in those opinions is in direct conflict with each other. KK says, don't read 48356 into the termination statutes. DF says, read it in. The other thing is that one of the issues here is the lack of permanence for the child. If the case is remanded back to the circuit court for a determination on abandonment, then we have, we have the time for the decision from the Court of Appeals to be transmitted back to the trial court. Then we have the jury trial that's set up. This court saw in the record how long it took to get from initial appearance on the TPR to final resolution of the TPR. It took almost a year. So then we have Brittany sitting in a foster home with these foster parents that she's had for over 4 years now. She waits another year to decide for a court to determine if, in fact, her parental rights be terminated. I think it's contrary to allowing for termination at the earliest and most appropriate instance.
Chief? Justice Bradley.
Let me give you a hypothetical and forget the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act, if you know it. My concern is once enough? We're dealing with a fundamental right. We're dealing with argued as a fundamental right, a parent's relationship with the child. And certainly there are plenty of cases that say that your title as a parent due process before that relationship is terminated. Hypothetical. A soldier defending his country is someplace other than this country. The mother of the child is unfit, chips proceeding, goes on for a couple of years. The soldier gets one warning as he's serving someplace else, and that's it. And then his parental rights can be lawfully terminated. Is that enough? No, we're not making the law just for this situation, but for all sorts of situations. And we're dealing with such a fundamental relationship here.
I think it is sufficient. If I can alter the hypothetical for a minute, one warning under abandonment is sufficient. The issue here in continuing needs is, do you need it every single time? I guess in that fact scenario, it would be unfortunate, but I think the legislature writes with a pretty blunt instrument when it's making decisions on this case and doesn't prepare for the eventuality of those cases. I think in a situation like that, I would hope that counsel who represented the petitioner would be looking at other ways to get around it, but I think that is a concern. And I won't go into the separate provisions that are in the statute for notice for termination of parental rights for soldiers. But the essence of the hypothetical, I think, does cause some concern, but I think the legislature has chosen to not address that instance and trying to address maybe the majority of cases that they see.
Thank you, Mr. Jameson. That concludes our hearing in Waukesha County versus Stephen H. And the court will be...